Imagine a molecule that is older than the Great Pyramid of Giza,
Right.
but at the same time, it was synthesized in a lab before the Wright brothers even flew a plane.
It's a crazy paradox.
It really is. And you know, today, you look around and the cultural conversation is just absolutely saturated with this, well, this psychedelic
Oh, it's
renaissance.
everywhere. It's inescapable.
Right. You've got Silicon Valley executives like microdosing LSD. Major universities are running all these clinical trials on magic mushrooms. And the media treats it all as this completely novel, brand new frontier of human consciousness.
Which is funny because it's not new at all.
Exactly. To truly understand any of this modern neuropharmacology, we have to look at the blueprint for you, the listener, the absolute granddaddy of them all. I mean, we're talking about mescaline.
It is the bedrock of the entire field, honestly. Without mescaline, the whole paradigm of modern psychopharmacology, and our understanding of how chemistry alters human perception, it just simply does not exist.
So, today, our mission on this deep dive is to unpack this massive, truly comprehensive dossier from the OATW Journal. It focuses on mescaline and the two primary cacti that produce it, which are peyote and San Pedro.
It's a fascinating collection of data.
We are going to explore a 5,000-year continuous history. We're going to dissect the exact neuropharmacology of, how this unique compound literally hacks the human brain. And we'll examine the severe unfolding conservation crisis that the modern psychedelic movement is, frankly, largely ignoring.
Which is a huge problem.
Yeah. So by the time we finish this deep dive, you're going to have a complete, really nuanced understanding of the foundation of this entire field.
And we really have to begin by addressing the sheer scale of the timeline here.
Right. The timeline is wild.
Because when we talk about mescaline use, we are not talking about like a recent countercultural phenomenon for the 1960s or even a 19th century medical discovery. We are looking at the oldest chemically confirmed use of a psychedelic plant in human history.
The archaeological data in this dossier is just staggering. It details radiocarbon dating performed on these dried peyote buttons that were recovered from Shimla Cave.
Yeah, down in Texas.
Exactly, in the really arid Pecos River region of southern Texas. And the dating places those specific specimens at roughly 5,700 years old.
5.7 millennia. It's incredible.
And because of the incredibly dry, sheltered conditions of that cave system, modern chemists were actually able to extract and analyze the remaining alkaloids inside those tiny dried buttons.
They didn't just find fossilized plant matter.
Right. They didn't just guess what the plant was used for, they confirmed the actual presence of mescaline.
That chemical confirmation is what separates this from mere anthropological speculation, you know.
Yeah.
We have definitive proof that indigenous populations in the Chihuahuan Desert were harvesting, preserving, and actively consuming this specific neuroactive compound nearly 6 millennia ago.
Which just blows my mind.
And crucially, this usage wasn't just isolated to North America. If we shift our focus thousands of miles south, down to the high-altitude slopes of the Andes Mountains in Peru, we find an entirely different mescaline-bearing plant.
Right, the San Pedro cactus or Huachuma.
Yes, exactly.
The dossier points to these stone carvings and monumental art at the Chavín de Huántar archaeological site. You have these massive subterranean stone labyrinths dating back roughly 3,000 years.
And the art down there is so specific.
It is. You've got these deities carved into the stone holding unmistakable ribbed columnar cacti. So you have two completely distinct geographies, right?
Very different environment.
A harsh, low-altitude desert in Mexico and Texas, and then the freezing high-altitude Andes. But both are utilizing the exact same molecule to alter human consciousness for millennia.
This establishes a really vital context for everything that follows in our discussion today.
Yeah.
This molecule is not a recreational drug that later acquired some sort of spiritual veneer.
Right. It didn't start at a music festival.
It's exactly. From those deep cave systems 5,700 years ago to the ceremonies being conducted tonight by the Native American Church or Andean curanderos, the lineage of sacramental use is entirely unbroken. It is a living tradition.
But the timeline of mescaline doesn't just dominate ancient history. I mean, it completely rewrites our understanding of modern science. When people think about the quote-unquote discovery of psychedelics, the popular narrative almost always jumps to the mid-20th century.
Yep, the 1940s and 50s.
Right. We think of Albert Hofmann accidentally absorbing LSD through his skin in 1943, or Gordon Wasson bringing psilocybin mushrooms to the attention of the West in the 1950s. But mescaline predated all of that by decades.
Decades. It's the absolute pioneer. Long before the word psychedelic was even coined, scientists were turning to the peyote cactus to understand the fundamental chemistry of the mind.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the breakthrough actually happened in 1897.
1897. It's so early.
Right. There was a German pharmacologist named Arthur Hefter. He was studying the peyote cactus, trying to determine exactly which chemical inside this bitter plant was responsible for the profound visionary states reported by indigenous groups.
But, you know, he didn't have modern neuroimaging.
No, no MRI machines, no receptor assays, so he had to rely on the purest, most grueling form of the scientific method, self-experimentation.
Which is just wild to think about by today's standards. Hefter systematically isolated the different alkaloid fractions from the plant.
Compounds like pelletine, halonidine, and lefaforine.
Exactly. He would extract a specific alkaloid, purify it, and then personally ingest it. Then he'd meticulously record his physiological and psychological reactions in his journals.
He literally used his own nervous system as the testing apparatus.
The ultimate guinea pig.
I mean, could you imagine just isolating random desert plant chemicals and eating them in a lab? But he found that the other alkaloids might cause sleepiness or like an elevated heart rate, but they didn't produce the profound visual and cognitive shift.
They weren't the magic bullet.
No. Finally, he isolated a specific compound, took a 150 milligram dose of its sulfate salt, and experienced the vivid geometric visual phenomena characteristic of the cactus. He had successfully isolated mescaline,
which officially made mescaline the very first psychedelic compound ever chemically identified by modern science.
Mm.
And, you know, the timeline pushes even further.
Oh, this part is amazing.
In 1919, in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, an Austrian chemist named Ernst Speth achieved the first full laboratory synthesis of the molecule. He didn't just extract it from the plant anymore. He built it from raw chemical precursors.
He created a purely synthetic psychedelic in 1919. That is mind-blowing.
It's a huge milestone.
And this was the exact synthetic molecule that the British author Aldous Huxley famously consumed in 1953 under the supervision of psychiatrist Humphrey Osmond. That single experience led Huxley to write The Doors of Perception.
A massively influential book.
Yeah, it practically single-handedly primed Western culture for the entire concept of chemical mind expansion. When we casually refer to the classic psychedelics today, we are talking about a category that mescaline entirely defined.
Absolutely. For the first half of the 20th century, if you were a psychiatrist or chemist studying altered states of consciousness, mescaline was your gold standard reference material.
It was the undisputed archetype. And yet, when we look closely at its molecular architecture in the dossier, we find that it's actually the chemical oddball of the classic psychedelic family.
It really is. It is structurally isolated from the others.
Let's dig into that chemistry for you, because the structural blueprints here dictate everything. The full chemical name is 3,4-5-esterase-trimethoxyphenethylamine.
Try saying that three times fast.
Ha, right. But the crucial identifier there is the suffix phenethylamine.
Phenethylamine is the skeletal core of the molecule. If you strip away the methoxy groups decorating the outside of the molecule, you are left with this fundamental structural backbone. And that backbone separates it entirely from substances like psilocybin, the active compound in magic mushrooms, or DMT, or LSD.
Because those other compounds are built on a tryptamine skeleton. They look remarkably similar to the neurotransmitter serotonin. But mescaline's phenethylamine skeleton looks like an amphetamine.
Exactly. It's a completely different shape.
It is chemically in the same overarching structural family as dopamine, norepinephrine, and adrenaline. You know, the body's core stimulants.
The fight or flight chemicals.
Right. So think of it this way. The phenethylamine skeleton is essentially a master key cut inside the body's pure energy factory. It's designed to lock into the receptors that drive focus, alertness, and the fight-or-flight response.
Okay, I like that analogy.
The tryptamine skeleton, on the other hand, is a completely different key, cut in the perception factory, designed to interact with mood, sensory processing, and serotonin. So, mescaline is fascinating because it's a master key cut from the energy factory that has somehow been perfectly filed down and modified over millions of years of plant evolution to suddenly fit into the brain's perception locks.
That structural quirk is exactly what made it so influential to later chemists, actually.
Because it's so modifiable, right?
Yes. Because it possessed this unique, highly modifiable phenethylamine skeleton, it became the ultimate blank canvas. The legendary psychopharmacologist Alexander Shulgin used mescaline as his foundational template.
Oh, Shulgin is a legend.
He really is. In his lab, he would take that core mescaline structure and make microscopic alterations, moving a methoxy group here, adding a carbon atom there. Through those minute tweaks, Shorgan generated an entire library of novel psychedelic compounds, birthing the 2C family and countless others.
So mescaline's unique shape was basically the Rosetta Stone for an entire branch of synthetic chemistry.
It was the starting point for everything he did, yeah.
But that unique shape also presents this massive biological paradox that the dossier points out. If mescaline is structurally built like a stimulant, how on earth does it produce a deeply visionary, classical psychedelic experience that mirrors the tryptamine molecules like psilocybin?
It's a great question.
If the keys are cut in completely different factories, how are they unlocking the exact same destination in human consciousness?
To understand that, we have to transition from the structure of the molecule to the mechanics of the brain itself. We have to look at the shared neurological engine of the psychedelic state, which is the serotonin 5-HT2A receptor.
The OOTW dossier goes incredibly deep into the neuropharmacology here. The core revelation is that despite possessing an amphetamine-like skeleton, mescaline acts in the central nervous system as a direct serotonin receptor agonist.
It's sneaky like that.
It enters the brain, bypasses the primary dopamine and adrenaline locks you would expect it to fit into, and binds directly to the serotonin pathways.
It acts across a spectrum of receptors, to be fair. It has affinity for 5-HT2C, 5-HT2B, 5-HT1A, and it does retain a modest amount of alpha-2 adrenergic activity.
Which explains some of its physically stimulating properties, right?
Exactly. That stimulant heritage is still there a bit. But the 5-HT2A receptor is the master switch. When mescaline binds to 5-HT2A, it triggers a conformational change in the receptor that initiates the profound cascade of the psychedelic experience.
And the scientific community doesn't just suspect this, they have rigorously proven it. The dossier cites recent, highly controlled clinical trials, specifically NCT-04849013 and the 2024 work by Halberstadt and colleagues.
The pharmacological subtraction trials.
Yes. They utilize this technique called pharmacological subtraction, which honestly sounds like something out of a science fiction novel, but it provides absolute airtight proof of how these compounds work.
What's fascinating here is that pharmacological subtraction is one of the most elegant and definitive tools we have in neuropharmacology. In these trials, researchers administer a drug called ketanserin to the human subjects prior to giving them mescaline.
And ketanserin is a highly selective 5-HT2A antagonist.
Exactly. It's a blocker.
So because it's an antagonist, it acts like a broken key snapped off inside a lock. It binds to the 5-HT2A receptor with high affinity, but it has zero intrinsic efficacy. It doesn't activate the receptor. It just aggressively occupies the space, occluding the orthosteric site so nothing else can get in.
That's spot on. So the researchers flood the brain with ketanserin, effectively bolting all the 5-HT2A doors shut. Then they administer a full dose of mescaline.
And the result is wild.
The result is consistently remarkable. The ketanserin blockade prevents or almost entirely reverses the subjective psychedelic effects of the mescaline. The profound visual distortions, the ego dissolution, the altered state of consciousness, they simply fail to materialize.
The person might experience like a slight rise in heart rate from the residual adrenergic activity, but the psychedelic house remains completely dark. The magic just cannot happen if that specific serotonin door is locked.
It's absolute proof of the mechanism.
We see this exact same ketanserin blockade signature with LSD and psilocybin. The brain is processing vastly different botanical chemistries through a single shared biological bottleneck.
And once mescaline successfully binds to that 5-HT2A receptor and opens the door, it initiates a massive downstream neurological cascade. The primary action occurs on layer 5 cortical pyramidal neurons.
Layer 5 cortical pyramidal neurons? Okay, these are the massive, highly connected neurons that span the layers of the cortex.
Yes, the big ones.
They act as the primary output pathways, integrating signals from all over the brain and funneling them down to lower subcortical structures. They are the heavy lifters of human cognition.
When mescaline activates the 5-HT2A receptors clustered on the apical dendrites of these layer 5 neurons, it fundamentally alters the way the brain routes information.
It scrambles the normal routing.
Exactly. We see a dramatic collapse in the integrity of the default mode network, or DMN. The DMN is essentially the brain's main control hub for self-referential processing. It's the neurological basis for our sense of ego, our rigid behavioral loops, and our internal monologues.
And as the DMN loses its grip, the dossier says we observe a radical spike in neural entropy.
Neural entropy is such a fascinating concept in this space.
It really is. If you picture the normal waking brain as this highly disciplined, rigidly organized traffic grid where signals only travel down designated highways, neural entropy is what happens when you suddenly turn that grid into a boundless open field.
No more traffic lights.
Exactly. Networks that normally never communicate, like your visual cortex and your auditory processing centers, or your memory hubs and your emotional centers, suddenly begin talking to each other directly. You get this massive, fluid crosstalk.
And this high entropy state is the physical manifestation of the expanded mind. It allows the user to break out of entrenched thought patterns, which is why these compounds show such promise in disrupting conditions like rigid depression or addiction.
Because it shakes up the rigid grid.
Right. And mechanistically, mescaline drives this process just as effectively as the other classic psychedelics. It strongly activates the 5-HT2A to BDNF-TRKB pathway.
Let's expand on that pathway, because BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is thrown around constantly in longevity and neuroscience discussions, often without explaining what it actually does.
It's a buzzword right now, for sure.
BDNF is a highly specialized protein that acts essentially like Miracle-Gro for the brain.
A very precise analogy. When mescaline stimulates the 5-HT2A receptor, it signals the cell to release BDNF. That BDNF then binds to its own specific receptor called TRKB.
And what does that binding actually do?
This binding triggers a phosphorylation cascade inside the neuron that physically alters the architecture of the cell. It promotes dendritogenesis, which is the sprouting of new dendritic branches, and synaptogenesis, the formation of new connections between neurons.
Wow.
So mescaline doesn't just change how you feel momentarily. It catalyzes the physical rewiring of the brain's hardware.
So on a cellular and mechanistic level, mescaline is doing exactly what LSD and psilocybin do. It utilizes the same 5-HT2A key, collapses the same default mode network, and drives the same BDNF neuroplasticity.
Mechanistically, yes, it's very similar.
But here is the massive contradiction that the dossier presents. If it is hitting the exact same receptors and producing a qualitatively similar altered state, why does mescaline have such a daunting reputation? Why is it universally considered an incredibly demanding, heavy undertaking compared to the other classics?
Because we cannot separate the neurology from the physical reality of the molecule's pharmacokinetics. The answer lies in the sheer, unrelenting passage of time and the profound physiological toll it exacts on the human body.
This shifts our focus to the duration and dosage data, and the numbers here are absolutely staggering. The dossier highlights extensive dose-finding trials conducted by Matthias Liechti's research group in Basel.
They do excellent work over there.
They really do. They meticulously mapped out the pharmacokinetics of pure, synthesized mescaline across a wide range of doses in healthy human volunteers.
And the duration is what truly isolates mescaline in the clinical landscape. The Basel group tested ascending doses, starting at 100 milligrams and pushing up to 800 milligrams. At the absolute baseline dose of 100 milligrams, they found the mean duration of the subjective experience was 6.4 hours.
6.4 hours for a threshold dose? Just to orient that for a baseline for you listening, a full moderate dose of psilocybin mushrooms typically lasts 4 to 6 hours from start to finish. Mescaline is just getting out of bed at the six-hour mark.
Exactly. When the researchers escalated the dose to a moderate therapeutic range, so between 300 to 500 milligrams, the experience stretched out to a staggering 10 to 12 hours.
10 to 12 hours.
And at the high-end dose of 800 milligrams, the altered state persisted for up to 14 hours.
14 hours of a peak, non-ordinary state of consciousness that is an absolute endurance event.
It's a marathon.
Even LSD, which is infamous for its duration, generally resolves within 9 to 12 hours. Mescaline's metabolic pathway is remarkably slow. You ingest it at 8 in the morning, and as the sun goes down at 18 or at night, you are still navigating profound ego dissolution and visual phenomena.
Which can be exhausting.
And the difficulty isn't just the length of the journey, it is the brutality of the launch. The onset of mescaline is notoriously slow and physically taxing.
Very taxing. It generally takes a full 1 to 2 hours just to begin feeling the primary psychological effects. And that onset window is dominated by a strong sympathomimetic response.
Meaning what exactly?
Because mescaline retains that amphetamine-like structural heritage we talked about, it activates the sympathetic nervous system, the fight-or-flight pathway. Safety pharmacology studies, like the 2024 work by Klaber and colleagues, show that it reliably and dose-dependently elevates blood pressure and heart rate.
So your heart is pounding.
Right. You experience this intense physical stimulation long before the mind expands.
And coupled with that cardiovascular stimulation is the gastrointestinal reality. Mescaline is a severe gastric irritant. The dossier notes that extreme nausea and frequently violent vomiting are reliable, almost guaranteed early physical events.
It's incredibly common.
Which makes me want to play skeptic for a second. Who has the time for a 14-hour experience? And why would someone...
That is the central friction between Western pharmacology and indigenous wisdom. In the traditional context of the Native American church, or the Andean Huachumaros, the nausea and the vomiting are not categorized as unfortunate side effects.
They aren't trying to engineer it away.
No, they are not bugs in the system to be engineered away. The purge is understood as an integral, non-negotiable component of the medicine. It is the physical manifestation of the healing process. The body is purging accumulated negative energy, physical toxins, and spiritual blockages.
So the physical toll is the initiation. It demands a level of somatic surrender that a shorter, clear, synthetic experience simply does not require. You are forced to sit in the absolute discomfort of your physical biology before you are granted access to the visionary headspace.
Surrender is the critical mechanism there. And this demanding profile creates a fascinating dichotomy in its safety profile. On a strictly physiological basis, mescaline is remarkably safe.
Despite the intense physical reaction.
Yes. The therapeutic index, which is the safety margin between an active dose and a lethal dose, is exceptionally wide. There is no established record of lethal overdose from its direct pharmacological action at anywhere near typical doses. Furthermore, it doesn't act on the dopamine reward pathways in a way that creates physical addiction, and the brain rapidly builds a profound tolerance to the 5-HT2A stimulation, naturally limiting repetitive daily use.
So your body can physically handle it, provided you don't have underlying severe cardiovascular disease that would make the blood pressure spike dangerous. But the psychological risk is an entirely different story.
The psychological risk is immense, and it is directly tethered to that 14-hour duration.
Because it's just so much time to be in that state.
Exactly. Navigating a challenging psychological space, confronting repressed trauma, experiencing existential dread, or entering a loop of intense anxiety is difficult enough during a 4-hour psilocybin trial. Attempting to navigate that kind of psychological turbulence over a 12 to 14-hour window is a grueling marathon.
I can't even imagine.
It requires an incredibly sturdy psychological container, dedicated external support, and a meticulously controlled setting.
It also requires strict adherence to standard pharmacological contraindications. The dossier emphasizes that anyone with a personal or family history of psychosis, schizophrenia, or severe bipolar disorder faces a major risk of triggering latent conditions. But there is also a critical, potentially lethal drug interaction regarding MAOI's monoamine oxidase inhibitors.
This is a vital point of safety. Monoamine oxidase is an enzyme acting as the brain's waste management system.
Like the cleanup crew.
Right. Its primary function is to break down and clear away excess neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine from the synaptic cleft. Many older antidepressants and some natural compounds act as MAOIs, paralyzing this cleanup enzyme.
So if a person artificially paralyzes their brain's ability to clear away serotonin and then introduces a powerful, long-lasting serotonergic compound like mescaline,
the brain floods.
The serotonin accumulates to toxic levels, triggering serotonin syndrome, which can be rapidly fatal. The physical safety of mescaline relies entirely on the body's natural metabolic pathways remaining unimpeded.
You cannot mix it with those medications. It's incredibly dangerous.
But this intense physical requirement, the necessity of consuming large amounts of crude, slowly metabolizing plant material, forces us to look at the source of that material, the plants themselves. And the dossier outlines a stark biological contrast between the two primary carriers of this molecule. We are shifting from neuropharmacology into environmental ecology.
And here we encounter a massive ecological and ethical divide. The biological realities of these two distinct cacti dictate entirely different relationships with human demand.
Let's begin with the species that dominates the North American discourse, peyote. The botanical name is Lophophora williamsi. For those who haven't seen it, peyote does not look like the towering branched saguaro cacti you see in Western movies.
No, not at all.
It is a tiny, squat, spineless, blue-green cactus. It grows nearly flush with the ground, hiding in the limestone scrub of the Chihuahuan Desert, which is an ecosystem that stretches across northern Mexico and a narrow band of South Texas.
The anatomy of the plant is crucial to understand here. The visible portion above the dirt is called the crown. During a harvest, a skilled practitioner will cleanly slice this crown off laterally, leaving the subterranean stem and the massive taproot intact beneath the soil, which allows the plant to eventually regenerate a new crown.
And these harvested dried crowns are colloquially known as buttons.
Exactly, peyote buttons.
But the biological bottleneck here is the sheer concentration of the alkaloid. According to the data, a single average-sized peyote button contains roughly 25 to 50 milligrams of mescaline.
And if we reference the lychee clinical trials we discussed, a moderate, fully active dose requires anywhere from 300 to 500 milligrams.
Doing the math, achieving a single ceremonial dose requires the consumption of multiple buttons, often 5, 10, or even more, depending on the individual plant's potency. If peyote grew like a weed, this wouldn't be an issue. But it possesses a devastating biological vulnerability. Its growth rate is agonizingly slow.
Incredibly slow.
The harsh realities of the Tarawan Desert, the extreme heat, the prolonged droughts, the necessity of producing complex, bitter alkaloids as a defense mechanism against herbivores mean the plant conserves its energy tightly. The journal notes that a single peyote plant can take well over a decade to reach maturity. Some estimates place the growth cycle at up to 15 years in the wild just to produce a single harvestable button.
15 years of surviving one of the harshest climates on the continent just to yield a fraction of a single human dose. It is a supremely fragile reproductive and growth cycle.
Now, contrast that staggering biological bottleneck with the other major lineage, San Pedro, or Echinopsis pacanoi. We leave the low desert and travel to the high, fertile slopes of the Andes Mountains in South America. The biological strategy of San Pedro is the exact inverse of peyote.
San Pedro is a towering, vibrant green columnar cactus. Instead of hiding close to the earth, it shoots straight up into the canopy. And crucially, it is exceptionally fast-growing.
How fast are we talking?
In optimal conditions, a healthy San Pedro column can grow a foot or more in a single year. To prepare it, the green outer flesh, which contains the highest concentration of alkaloids, is stripped away, boiled in water for hours to extract the mescaline, and reduced into a thick, highly bitter brew.
So we have a tiny squat desert button that takes 15 years to grow an inch, and a towering mountain column that grows a foot a year. Both synthesize the exact same 3,4, 4, and 5 trimethoxyphenethylamine molecule. This vast biological discrepancy is the absolute root of the conservation crisis outlined in the dossier.
It is a profound unfolding crisis. The exploding modern demand for psychedelics is clashing violently against the inflexible biological limits of the peyote cactus.
The dossier highlights that the Native American Church, the primary indigenous stewards of the plant in North America, formally declared a peyote crisis all the way back in 1995. They identified the existential threat to their sacrament over 3 decades ago, and the multifaceted threats driving this extinction event have only accelerated.
The habitat loss alone is devastating. In the specific tracts of South Texas where peyote naturally occurs, the land is largely privately owned, and we are seeing massive campaigns of root plowing.
Right. For anyone unfamiliar with South Texas agriculture, root plowing is a brutally efficient form of industrial land clearing. Heavy machinery pulls massive subterranean blades deep through the soil, severing the root systems of native brush to clear the land for cattle grazing or, increasingly, for energy development like wind farms and oil pads.
It's total devastation of the ecosystem.
It instantly annihilates entire ancient peyote habitats. The 15-year-old plants and their vital subterranean taproots are simply shredded and churned into the dirt.
Compounding the industrial habitat loss is the human extraction. You have rampant illegal poaching driven by the black market. You have ignorant harvesters who lack the traditional knowledge of how to cut the plant, slicing entirely through the subterranean stem rather than just the crown, which permanently kills the taproot and prevents any regeneration.
That's heartbreaking.
And accelerating all of this is the intense pressure of the modern psychedelic renaissance. Worldwide internet sales, the explosion of psychedelic tourism, the mainstreaming of plant medicines. A slow-growing desert plant that was quietly and sustainably stewarded by indigenous communities for millennia has suddenly become a globally demanded commodity.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This leads to a deeply counterintuitive paradox in the realm of modern drug policy. In progressive circles, the dominant rallying cry is broad decriminalization. Free the plants. Remove criminal penalties for all natural psychedelics. But when you look at the advocacy coming from groups like the Indigenous Peyote Conservation Initiative, or IPCI, they are actively fighting against the inclusion of peyote in broad decriminalization bills.
You'll want it left out.
Yes, they want peyote explicitly excluded from the psychedelic gold rush.
Because they understand the biological math. If you suddenly remove the legal barriers and make peyote broadly accessible to millions of newly curious Westerners, the resulting surge in mainstream commercial demand would rapidly accelerate the extinction of the plant in the wild.
The demand would just crush it.
Exactly. The species cannot survive being integrated into a decentralized mainstream therapeutic or recreational market. It simply grows too slowly.
They are essentially pleading with the modern psychedelic movement, do not invite the world to consume our vanishing sacrament. Broad decriminalization, ironically, would be an ecological death sentence for Lefaufura Williams CI.
This brings us to a clear ethical directive dictated by ecology. The vast difference in growth rates between the two cacti means that for the modern, mescaline-curious individual, plant choice is no longer just a matter of aesthetic preference. Because San Pedro is fast-growing, because it yields abundant mescaline, and because it is easily cultivated in greenhouses and gardens worldwide, it represents a highly sustainable, renewable resource.
Choosing the towering Andean column over the slow-growing desert button is an active, vital act of ecological conservation. If you are seeking the mescaline experience outside of a traditional, enrolled indigenous context, San Pedro is the only ethical path. You leave the peyote to the communities whose ancestors have stewarded it for five millennia. As you noted earlier, you aren't just taking a chemical, you are interacting with a fragile ecosystem.
Right, you're part of that system.
And this profound tension, a molecule that is simultaneously a Schedule I controlled substance, a 5,000-year-old living indigenous sacrament, and an endangered botanical species, forces us to look at how modern law attempts to categorize something this inherently complex.
The legal framework is a labyrinth of contradictions, paradoxes, and highly specific carve-outs that attempt to balance prohibition with cultural survival.
Starting at the federal level in the United States, the baseline is total prohibition. Mescaline as a synthesized molecule and peyote specifically as a botanical source are classified as Schedule I controlled substances under the Controlled Substances Act.
The strictest schedule.
That classification dictates that the federal government considers them to have a high potential for abuse, a lack of accepted safety protocols, and absolutely no currently accepted medical use and treatment.
A classification that stands in stark, ironic contrast to the thousands of years of continuous community-integrated healing use we discussed. However, the federal government was eventually forced to recognize a crucial, strictly defined exception.
The dossier details the intense political and legal struggles that culminated in the American Indian Religious Freedom Act amendments of 1994, which were supported by subsequent DEA regulations, specifically 21 CFR 1307.31. This framework established federal protection for the sacramental use of peyote.
But it is an incredibly narrow, closed-loop legal space. It strictly protects the possession, transportation, and consumption of peyote only for enrolled members of the Native American Church in bona fide religious ceremonies.
The Native American Church, formally chartered in 1918, operates within this highly protected sphere. The law is a formal recognition of that unbroken lineage. It acknowledges that for these specific communities, the plant is not a drug in the Western pharmacological sense, but a literal deity and sacrament.
And we see similar recognitions internationally. The dossier mentions the ongoing practices of the Wixárika, or Huichol people in Mexico.
And they do the annual pilgrimage, right?
Yes. Every year, they undertake a massive, arduous pilgrimage across the country to Wirikuta, their sacred desert in San Luis Potosi, to hunt and harvest the peyote they call jicuri. The law is clumsily attempting to carve out a protected sanctuary for these ancient living traditions to persist, despite the blanket federal prohibition of the molecule itself.
But if you step one inch outside of that specific enrolled indigenous framework, the possession of peyote or mescaline reverts to a severe federal crime. However, the legal landscape becomes truly fascinating when we analyze recent state-level policy reforms, particularly the wave of natural psychedelic decriminalization.
The state level is where things get really nuanced.
When I was examining the modern legal landscape in the dossier, the 2022 Colorado Proposition 122 immediately stood out. This was a landmark voter-approved measure that decriminalized the personal use, cultivation, and sharing of a broad slate of natural plant-based psychedelics. It explicitly legalized the personal use of psilocybin mushrooms, DMT, ibogaine, and mescaline.
Right, but they made a huge exception.
They did. The lawmakers included a deliberate, highly specific exclusion. They explicitly excluded peyote from the decriminalization framework. At first glance, that looks completely contradictory. Why legalize the active molecule but criminalize the primary plant that produces it?
It seems backwards until you look at the biology.
Exactly. When you view it through the lens of the 15-year growth cycle, the root plowing, and the extinction crisis we just discussed, it reveals itself as an incredibly sophisticated piece of legislation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a masterclass in using drug prohibition as a targeted conservation shield. The lawmakers and advocates in Colorado listened directly to the Indigenous Peyote Conservation Initiative. They understood that fully decriminalizing peyote would invite a massive, unmanageable rush of demand that would decimate the remaining slow-growing wild populations.
So they essentially used prohibition to protect it.
Yes. They legislated a deliberate carve-out. They intentionally left the criminal prohibition in place for that specific plant to honor indigenous stewardship and protect a vulnerable species from the crushing weight of the very psychedelic renaissance that the proposition was otherwise championing.
It's a brilliant paradox, keeping a plant illegal in order to save its life. But that raises a practical question. If the state of Colorado decriminalizes mescaline but keeps peyote strictly illegal, where is the legally permissible mescaline supposed to come from?
Which leads us perfectly into one of the strangest, most fascinating loopholes in modern drug law, the legal status of San Pedro.
This loophole is wild. Explain how federal law handles the San Pedro cactus, because it highlights the absolute absurdity of trying to legally categorize nature.
Under federal law, live San Pedro cacti occupy an entirely gray, contradictory niche. Because Echinopsis pachynoi is a beautiful, hardy, incredibly fast-growing columnar cactus, it is widely utilized in landscaping and horticulture. As a result, it is entirely legal to buy, sell, and cultivate San Pedro as an ornamental plant.
Like, you can just buy it at a garden center.
You can walk into major hardware stores, local nurseries, or garden centers across the United States and legally purchase a live, mescaline-producing San Pedro cactus to plant in your front yard.
You can literally buy a factory that produces a Schedule I-controlled substance, set it next to the potting soil and the petunias, and put it on your windowsill legally.
Exactly. The organism itself is legal, provided it is treated strictly as an ornamental houseplant. However, the exact moment your intent shifts, the moment you slice the skin, boil the flesh in a pot of water, or attempt any chemical extraction to access the mescaline inside you, have crossed a legal threshold.
Your intent makes it illegal.
You are immediately engaging in the unlawful manufacture and possession of a Schedule I-controlled substance.
It all hinges on intent. The exact same botanical entity sitting in a terracotta pot is perfectly legal, but that same entity sitting in a boiling pot of water makes you a felon. The legal system forces the citizen to engage in a pantomime, pretending that this ancient Andean sacrament is nothing more than a pretty piece of desert decor.
It's an enforcement nightmare, really.
And the dossier points out that despite recent federal momentum, like the April 2026 executive order directing federal agencies to rapidly accelerate research into various psychedelic therapies, the government explicitly did not reschedule or legalize mescaline. It remains firmly locked within this chaotic web of Schedule F federal prohibition, strict religious exemptions, nuanced state-level conservation exclusions, and bizarre ornamental loopholes.
It is a fractured legal landscape that perfectly mirrors the profound complexity of the compound itself. It defies any attempt at neat, binary categorization.
It truly does. And as we pull all these disparate threads together, from deep prehistory to receptor pharmacology to desert ecology and constitutional law, that sheer unyielding complexity is the defining takeaway of this entire deep dive. We have covered an immense expanse of material today for you.
It's a lot to process.
To synthesize all of this data, mescaline is a molecule defined by extremes. It represents the oldest chemically confirmed psychedelic use by humanity, with a lineage stretching back nearly 6,000 years into the caves of Texas and the subterranean temples of Peru. Yet, paradoxically, it was the very first psychedelic to be isolated and synthesized by modern science, serving as the foundational blueprint that launched the entire field of 20th century psychopharmacology.
It's ancient and modern at the exact same time.
It is chemically unique, an amphetamine-like phenethylamine, yet neurologically it functions as a master key, unlocking the exact same 5-HT2A receptor and driving the exact same BDNF neuroplasticity cascade as the classic tryptamines like LSD and psilocybin.
And experientially, it demands more from the human user than almost any other compound in its class. It is an exhausting 14-hour physical and psychological marathon, initiated by a grueling physiological purge that indigenous traditions view as the vital mechanism of healing.
And crucially, the primary traditional botanical source of this molecule, the 15-year-old peyote cactus, is currently trapped in a devastating multi-front conservation crisis. The survival of this sacred plant relies entirely on modern seekers making the ethical, ecological choice to utilize the sustainable, fast-growing San Pedro cactus instead. So what does this all mean?
Well, when you look at all these facets combined, the core lesson of mescaline is that the responsible path forward through this modern psychedelic renaissance requires us to look far beyond the isolated mechanism of a chemical compound in a vacuum.
We can't just isolate the chemical and ignore the rest.
Exactly. It requires us to profoundly honor the deep ecology of the fragile environments these plants inhabit, and to respect the unbroken indigenous lineages that have stewarded that knowledge for millennia. You simply cannot separate the molecule from the soil, or the chemistry from the culture.
The medicine demands absolute context. It requires respect for the integrity of the whole system, not just the extraction of a neurological benefit. And as always, we want to leave you with a final thought, something to turn over in your mind that builds on the incredible tension we've explored today between the ancient biological reality and the modern scientific drive. Considering everything we've unpacked regarding Ernst Speth's 1919 laboratory synthesis and the grueling, nausea-inducing demands of consuming the crude, slow-growing desert plants, I want to throw this over to our expert to frame a final question for you.
Here is a biological and philosophical paradox for you to mull over independently. If the intense nausea, the harsh, bitter taste, and the brutal 14-hour endurance test of consuming the raw cactus are not side effects, but are historically considered by indigenous cultures to be the very mechanisms of healing, the necessary somatic purge, the physical initiation, the ultimate surrender of the ego to the body, what happens when modern science inevitably scales the synthesis of mescaline into a perfectly clean, targeted, nausea-free pharmaceutical pill?
That's the big question.
If we successfully extract the molecule in a pristine laboratory and entirely engineer away the harshness, the purge, and the 15-year struggle of the desert plant, are we perfecting the medicine for a frictionless modern world? Or, in our endless, distinctly Western quest for comfort and efficiency, are we fundamentally stripping away the ancient teacher?
We love to put history into neat, clean little boxes. But maybe the most profound shifts in human consciousness aren't meant to be clean. Maybe the mud, the bitter taste, the time, and the physical struggle are exactly where the healing actually lives. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the blueprint molecule. Stay curious, and we will see you next time.